You know, it's sad as Christians that we fail to understand and appreciate the value of suffering. There's a lady named Tatiana Gorycheva, a Russian Christian dissident who, during the waning years of the Soviet Empire, wrote this. She said, quote, "It's a pity that the West today does not understand the value of suffering, its power to renew and purge, that it does not understand that the main thing is not a question of physical pain or even death, but the question of meaning. The martyrs who gave their life for Christ glowed with joy, and the experience of the persecuted Russian church says to us quite clearly that suffering for God does not take us away from Him, but on the contrary brings us nearer to Him." This is from someone who had experienced suffering firsthand. We have looked at different causes for affliction. Our series that we're in is called Purposeful Pain, and we're looking at different purposes for pain in our lives. And we looked at the fact that God causes us to be afflicted for other people's comfort, and that we are afflicted for the elect's salvation, and that we are afflicted to prove our faith, and that we are afflicted to make us mature. And tonight I'd like us to go to an Old Testament passage, Deuteronomy chapter 8. And this will have to be a two-part message. When we get done, you will probably have wished it were a three-part message. But the part that we'll look at tonight, I'd just like to title, "Afflicted to Humble Me." And before we read the passage, I want to set the stage here. In Deuteronomy, when Moses is speaking to the people, they have now spent 40 years traveling in the desert, living in tents. I mean, that's like starting back in 1966. Many of us don't even remember that date because we weren't around. And since 1966 until today, no, am I doing my math right? Yes. 1966 until today, traveling and living in tents in a hot Saharan desert. And when Moses spoke to these people, they were in three categories of ages. You first had those that were 60 and older. Okay, these are the people that can get discounted coffee at Hardee's. And you know how many of these people there were in the 60 and older category? There were four. There's Moses. There's Aaron, who's going to die in chapter 10. And then there are two other men, and that is who? Joshua and Caleb. So you have four men in the 60-plus age. And then you have this whole category here in the 20 to 40 age bracket. And these people who were in their teens, were under 20 when they were brought out of Egypt. God brought them out of Egypt. They were, you know, infants up to 19 years of age. And then you had below that, the 0 to 40 age, was a whole new generation of people that were the desert babies. These were the people that had been born in the wilderness and had known nothing but living in tents in the hot desert. And the reason, of course, that there's nobody else over 60 is that God had said to that whole generation, everybody that was 20 or older when they came out of Egypt, that they were going to die in the wilderness and they would not go into the promised land until this whole generation was dead, with the exception of Joshua and Caleb. Aaron would soon die. Moses himself was soon to die. And now, where we find them now, they're about to enter the promised land that was withheld from their parents because of their parents' disobedience. And here they are in the exact same place, the same encampment even, where their parents, 40 years earlier, had failed to pass the test of obedience. And they're about to face that same test that their parents failed. And Deuteronomy chapter 8, and really much of Deuteronomy, is on Moses' part like a farewell address. And on their part, it's like a commencement address. They're about to begin a new stage of life before they cross the Jordan River. And Moses, in this chapter, has one overarching concern in this address. And I'd like to just point this out before we read the chapter. Look at chapter 8, verse 2. "And you shall remember all the way which the Lord your God has led you." Look at verse 11. "Beware lest you forget the Lord your God by not keeping his commandments." Look at verse 18. "But you shall remember the Lord your God." And look at verse 19. "And it shall come about that if you ever forget the Lord your God." It's clear that his burden here is that they be reminded of certain things and not be allowed to forget them. And oh, how easy it is for people to forget, isn't it? That's why Peter wrote as an old man, he said, "I consider it right, as long as I am in this earthly dwelling, to stir you up by way of reminder." That's why Paul writes to the Philippians and he says, "To write the same things again to you is no trouble to me, and it's a safeguard for you," for me to write the same things over and over again to you. And it's especially easy for the younger generation to forget the lessons that were painfully taught to their parents. In fact, it's an evidence of youth and immaturity to be forgetful. And the only way past that is to continually remind them. And so that is what Moses is doing. In fact, Deuteronomy means the second law. It's the second giving of the law. He's reminding them of the law. And what, though, would God have this younger generation remember? Let's read this chapter. Deuteronomy chapter 8. I'll be reading out of the New American Standard. "All the commandments that I am commanding you today, you shall be careful to do, that you may live and multiply and go in and possess the land which the Lord swore to give to your forefathers. And you shall remember all the way which the Lord your God has led you in the wilderness these 40 years, that he might humble you, testing you to know what is in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. And he humbled you and let you be hungry and fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you understand that man does not live by bread alone, but man lives by everything that proceeds out of the mouth of the Lord. Your clothing did not wear out on you, nor did your foot swell these 40 years. Thus you are to know in your heart that the Lord your God was disciplining you, just as a man disciplines his son. Therefore you shall keep the commandments of the Lord your God, to walk in his ways and to fear him. For the Lord your God is bringing you into a good land, a land of brooks of water, of fountains and springs, flowing forth in valleys and hills, a land of wheat and barley, of vines and fig trees and pomegranates, a land of olive oil and honey, a land, verse 9, where you shall eat food without scarcity, in which you shall not lack anything, a land whose stones are iron, and out of whose hills you can dig copper. And when you have eaten and are satisfied, you shall bless the Lord your God for the good land which he has given you. But beware, verse 11, that lest you forget the Lord your God by not keeping his commandments and his ordinances and his statutes, which I am commanding you this day. Lest, when you have eaten and are satisfied and have built good houses and lived in them, and when your herds and your flocks multiply, and your silver and gold multiply, and all that you have multiplies, then that your heart becomes proud, and you forget the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. He led you through the great and terrible wilderness with its fiery serpents and scorpions and thirsty ground where there was no water. And he brought water for you out of the rock of flint, In the wilderness he fed you manna, which your fathers did not know, that he might humble you, that he might test you, to do good for you in the end. Otherwise, you may say in your heart, my power and the strength of my hand made me this wealth. But you shall remember the Lord your God, for it is he who has given you the power to make wealth, that he may confirm his covenant, which he swore to your fathers, as it is this day. And it shall come about, if you ever forget the Lord your God, and go after other gods and serve them and worship them, I testify against you today that you shall surely perish. Like the nations that the Lord makes to perish before you, so you shall perish, because you would not listen to the voice of the Lord your God. Notice that there had been a time when God let them go hungry. That's there in verse 3. And now they're going to a place, look down at verse 9, where you shall eat food without scarcity, in which you shall not lack anything. And the fear that Moses has is that, verse 12, look at it, when you have eaten and are satisfied and have built good houses and lived in them, and when your herds and your flocks multiply and your silver and your gold multiply and all that you have multiplies, then that your heart becomes proud and you forget the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. A God who, verse 15, a God who led you through the great and terrible wilderness with its fiery serpents and scorpions and thirsty ground where there was no water. A God, verse 16, who in the wilderness fed you manna which your fathers did not know. So God's concern here in Deuteronomy chapter 8 is this. God did not want the people of Israel to forget the lessons of adversity in the days of prosperity. Right? Do we understand that's what's going on? God does not want his people to forget the lessons of the days of adversity, those 40 years in the wilderness, during the days of prosperity. And it's a tragedy for the children of God to forget the lessons they learned during those days of adversity when God brings them into days of relative prosperity. And how sad it is when you witness someone who's gone through years of wilderness wandering, so to speak, and then they forget everything they learn when God ushers them into a land of plenty. God does not want us to forget the lessons of adversity in the days of prosperity. That's the overarching theme of this chapter. And to avoid this, then we need to remind ourselves of the lessons that we did learn in those days of adversity. So what would God have them then remember? When Moses comes and they're at the end of these days of adversity and they're about to enter days of prosperity, what is it that God would have them remember about those days of adversity, about those wilderness wanderings, about what he calls in verse 15 the great and terrible wilderness with its fiery serpents and scorpions and thirsty ground where there was no water? I mean, someone says, well, I'll never forget those scorpions. I mean, they were massive. And I'll never forget those fiery serpents. And I'll never forget the dryness and the parched throat and the thirsty land we were in. I mean, you think I'll ever forget that I suffered? Just let me tell you the ways I suffered. But what would God have them remember? And all of us can look back at days of relative adversity. Some of us were great adversity and long adversity. And we remember the scorpions or the serpents or whatever the pain was. But what would God have us remember when we look back on those days? And what does God not want us to forget? Well, look at chapter 8, verse 2. And you shall remember all the way which, here it is, the Lord your God has led you in the wilderness these 40 years. Here's number one. The first thing to remember about the days of adversity is this. God sovereignly ordained your days of adversity. Right? Is that not clear? You shall remember all the way which the Lord your God has led you. That's an active verb. That's not a passive concession. That's an active direction. And I personally get irritated, a holy irritation, of course, when people try to excuse God by saying that God allowed certain things. You know, he allowed Katrina to happen. As if, you know, God, on God's part, it was somehow an unwilling concession to an undesirable demand, but he had to allow it. But trust me, this isn't the way God is like. You know, please don't blame God. He had to allow that to happen. I mean, God didn't allow them to spend 40 years in the wilderness. Is that what it says? You remember all these, God allowed you to spend 40 years in the wilderness. He didn't allow them to wake up in the morning and find deadly snakes and monster scorpions in their tents. He didn't allow them to go hungry and thirsty. He says he led them to and through those days. Verse 7 says, look at verse 7. For the Lord your God is bringing you into a good land. Oh yeah, you know, that's God. You know, God's blessing us. Praise God. He's bringing us into a good land. Yeah, but notice verse 15. He led you through the great and terrible wilderness with the fiery serpents and scorpions and thirsty ground where there was no water. And there are different interpretations that these people could have given to those 40 years. To that 40-year hiatus, if you will, in national life, where everything just seemed to pause and nothing progressed. 40 years in which the infrastructure of the nation did not change at all. I mean, you think about it. 40 years ago, they were living in tents. And today, guess what? They're living in tents. 40 years ago, the only roads were the natural depressions between the sand dunes. And today, the only thing that has changed that are the shifting winds. 40 years ago, the only option available at the cafeteria was manna. And guess what the only option is today, after 40 years? 40 years ago, the style was a robe, a staff, and sandals. And 40 years later, they're still wearing the exact same clothes. 40 years ago, there was no permanent address to affix to their business cards. And 40 years later, there's still no place to call home. I mean, these people really lived. I mean, these were people. You pinched them, they hurt, okay? You called them names, they got mad. These were real people just like us. And they spent 40 years living in the wilderness. That's no small affliction. And there are different interpretations those people were probably tempted to give to the failure of national progress. And probably one, and it comes up earlier in the wilderness, is political. You know, it's these political leaders that have gotten us into this mess. I mean, Moses, at 120, is just too old to lead this nation. I mean, he got us into this, and now I just think he doesn't know how to get us out. And that's why there were some people that rebelled against Moses, because they saw Moses as the problem. Another was parental, no doubt. And I say this because it was because of their parents' sins that they were wandering through the wilderness. And so these people probably said, you know, it's mom and dad that really blew it back in the 60s. And 40 years later, we're still paying the consequences. And there are a lot of young people. There are a lot of young people that are bitter at their parents for the sins of their parents, that their parents committed, and the consequences that they themselves have to endure. I remember sitting across the table in the dining common at Bob Jones University with a friend whose father had to leave the ministry and come home from the mission field because of a moral failure. And, you know, this was not a matter of her father changing jobs. This is a matter of her family leaving the country she grew up in, the friends she had, the language she spoke, and never going back. And the biggest trial for her was the shame of it. And I remember her saying to me, she said, you know, I've always looked at certain other families, and she mentioned some families that we both knew, and thought, well, you know, well, we're different. And now it's my dad. And that's a shame she had to bear, though she'd done nothing. Her dad had sinned, she was bearing the consequences. And God gave her grace to trust His goodness and trust Him through it and grow by it. But many young people blame their parents for the trials they must endure, whether they think it's due to the sins of their parents or merely the stupidity of their parents. In fact, you know, it became a proverb in Israel. And the prophets Jeremiah and the prophets Ezekiel both refer to this proverb that was very obviously very common in Israel. And they both refer to it in a negative light, but the proverb went this way. Ezekiel 18 says, "Then the word of the Lord came to me, saying, what do you mean by using this proverb concerning the land of Israel, saying, quote, the fathers eat the sour grapes, but the children's," and they implied, you know, not the father's, "but the children's teeth are set on edge." You understand the Proverbs? The fathers eat the sour grapes, and it's the children's teeth who are set on edge. I mean, these were the people that had been thrust out of Jerusalem, and this is what they're complaining. Our fathers sinned, and we're bearing the consequences. And God says, what do you mean by using this proverb concerning the land of Israel? "As I live, declares the Lord God, you are surely not going to use this proverb in Israel anymore." So that's a very common way of thinking. You know, why did my dad have to move to that city? Or why did my dad have to take that job? Or why did my dad have to ruin my life by sending me to this university? So when it comes to days of adversity, one way the people were tempted to look at their problem was political, as political. This is the way Moses had led us. And another way they were tempted to look at their problem was parental. This is mom and dad's bad decisions and disobedience that has led us in here. But the way God would have them view all things, especially the days of adversity, was as providential. "You shall remember," our text there, "all the way which the Lord your God has led you." Yes, your parents sinned, but this was God leading you. And so when you look back on the days of adversity, as they did on theirs, the first thing God would have us remember is that God sovereignly ordained your days of adversity. But number two, the second thing that God would have these people remember about 40 years in the wilderness, 40 years of adversity, is that God designed those days of adversity to expose your hearts. Okay, God designed those days of adversity to expose your hearts. God has given to adversity what I'm going to call the ministry of exposition. Kind of like what we talked about this morning. The law does. What adversity exposes is the heart. Look at verse 2 again. Chapter 8, verse 2. "And you shall remember all the way which the Lord your God has led you in the wilderness these 40 years, that He might humble you." Now notice this. "Testing you to know what is in your heart, what was in your heart, whether you would keep His commandments or not." He led you in those wilderness, and wilderness, by the way, means hardship. And He's going to say later on, all the scorpions, snakes, all the things. "Testing you to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep His commandments or not." And please don't think of this knowing, okay, when He says to know what was in your heart as God gathering information. Okay. I think it was Tozer that said, has it ever occurred to you that nothing has ever occurred to God? Okay, God knows all things. He knows all men's heart. He looketh on the heart, in fact. And this is not God gathering information. Think of it more generally as God putting something into the category of that which can be known. God knows what was in their hearts, but their hearts are not known until they've been exposed. And so there's this ministry of exposition. It exposed their hearts. And it becomes clear as Moses now is going to progress through his farewell speech that he's giving them, that this ministry of exposition is intended not for the benefit of God, but for the benefit of the people. So when he wants to expose our hearts, it's not that it's for his benefit. And I'm going to show you this in a moment. It's actually for our benefit. The benefit of the people. So let me just put this in applicational terms again. Think back for a moment on some days of affliction. Some of you don't have to think back very far. Some of us can have to think back further. But think back on some affliction that you went through. You got it in your mind? Okay, God designed those times to expose to you, your own heart. And it's not like the results are unpredictable. Maybe it's going to be good. Maybe it's going to be bad. Affliction will always and only reveal one thing. And it won't be anything good. Look at chapter 9. Hear, O Israel. You're crossing over the Jordan today to go in to dispossess nations greater and mightier than you. Great cities fortified to heaven. A people great and tall, the sons of Anakim, whom you know and whom you have heard it said, who can stand before the sons of Anak? And remember, that's what their parents had said, and that's why their parents rebelled against God. And now they're going to face that exact same obstacle. Verse 3, know therefore today, that is, remember this, that it is the Lord your God who is crossing over before you as a consuming fire. And I'm going to emphasize this. He will destroy them, and He will subdue them before you so that you may drive them out and destroy them quickly, just as the Lord has spoken to you. In other words, God is going to do everything that's done. It's any good at all. And He's going to get all the credit for everything that happens. He's going to do it all. But now here's the temptation that they're being warned against. Look at verse 4, chapter 9. Do not say in your heart when the Lord your God has driven them out before you. That is, don't forget, right? And lie to yourself. Oh, because of my righteousness, the Lord has brought me in to possess the land. You ever say that? You know, well, those people, they just can't hold down a job. Why can't they just be like me? And the world would be a lot better place if people were just like me. Okay? But he says, no, don't say it's because of my righteousness that the Lord has brought me in to possess the land. You see those people going through a hard time? Well, no wonder. Look at them. Look at the way they're living. Excuse me, there went my watch. Which might be a good thing for me. Look at verse 5. It is not, okay? It is not, just in case you're going to miss the point, for your righteousness. And it's not for the uprightness of your heart that you are going to possess their land. Look at verse 6. Know then, that is, don't forget, that it is not because of your righteousness that the Lord your God is giving you this good land to possess. Okay, he's repeating it. And you're like, okay, you know, I get the point. But tell me why. Why not? For you are a stubborn people. KJV says, you have been rebellious against the Lord. And now you know what he's going to do to support that proposition? That if anything, here's his proposition, that if anything good happens to you, it's not because of you, it's because of God. That's his proposition. He's going to support that by reminding them of their days of affliction and the way they responded. He's going to say, let me prove it to you. Or you could put it this way, by reminding them of their evil hearts which were exposed back in those days of affliction. Look how he does it. Look at verse 7. Remember, okay, here's what he wants them to remember. Don't forget how you provoked the Lord your God to wrath in the wilderness. From the day that you left the land of Egypt until you arrived at this place, that's 40 years. You have been rebellious against the Lord. He's not talking to the parents, he's talking to the children. You want some examples? Okay, look at verse 8. Even in Horeb, you provoked the Lord to wrath. And the Lord was so angry with you that he would have destroyed you. That's how bad it was. That's how rebellious you were. And Moses reminds them of their sin at Horeb. He repeats to them the details of their sin. He says, you know, remember when I went up into the mountain for 40 days? Do you remember what you did and how the Lord almost destroyed you? Listen, when you get into that land and you get a nice house and you get a big vegetable garden behind and you have a nice vineyard down the street and you start making money, you know, on beef and on mutton, don't start thinking that you're a big shot and that you're somebody special. Just remember how you sinned when you had the opportunity to sin. And for 14 verses then, he's going to give them details of their failure. He's just telling them again how they failed. But you know what failures they are. Now go to verse 22. You want another illustration? Okay. Again at Taberah. And he reminds them of the second place this happened. And at Massa. You remember that one? There's a third place. And at Kibroth Hattaavah. You know, there's a fourth place. You provoked the Lord to wrath. Verse 23. And when the Lord sent you from Kadesh Barnea, there's a fifth place, saying, go up and possess the land which I have given you. Then you rebelled against the command of the Lord your God. You neither believed him nor listened to his voice. You have been rebellious against the Lord from the day I knew you. Wow, that's not a pump you up encouragement speech, is it? What Moses is saying to the people is this: God designed those days of adversity to expose your heart. Look back at chapter 8, verse 2. And you shall remember all the way which the Lord your God has led you in the wilderness those 40 years, that he might humble you. Notice this: testing you to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. And what was exposed was the fact that they didn't. It was not pretty. Which leads me to my third point. God sovereignly ordained your days of adversity. Remember that. Remember that God designed those days of adversity to expose your hearts. But there was a purpose in exposing your hearts. And it wasn't to make them feel good about themselves. I mean, that's obvious. And it wasn't merely for the pleasure of show and tell. Thirdly, God exposed your hearts to humble you. God exposed your hearts. And remember this. Those days of adversity, when your hearts were exposed, remember the way you responded? Remember how impatient you got? God exposed your hearts to humble you. Look at chapter 8, verse 2 again. You shall remember all the way which the Lord your God has led you in the wilderness these 40 years, that he might humble you, testing you to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. Do you see that, the logical progression of that verse? First, here, the Lord your God has led you into the wilderness these 40 years. He's the one sovereignly in charge of those days of adversity. And second, he did it that he might humble you. And thirdly, the way he humbled you was by testing you. That's the way he humbled you. He humbled you by testing you to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. That's why I listed my points this way. First, God sovereignly ordained your days of adversity. Then he exposed your hearts. And then he exposed your hearts in order to humble you. Do you know how humbling it is to fail a test? I was just talking to someone who said they got an F minus minus on a paper in an English class. In France, whether you take private music lessons or you're in the public conservatory, and for a time I was in both, they always have music exams. And these are some of the most, at least to me, okay, the most frightening and painful experiences. You would stand in this long corridor with all these other musicians, and one by one of the judges would come out and call somebody's name, and it was your turn, and you walked into the room and the door was shut behind you, and there against the wall or seated in a row were three or four or five judges just silent. And they would say, okay, play this scale. Now play your two songs. And, you know, you would try to play, and then you would leave. And I remember as a little kid just starting piano and having to go take my piano exam. That might sound funny to you, but it was fearful to me. And I remember crying after one of them, just being so nervous. You should try to play the trumpet when you're nervous. I can't even play very well when I'm not nervous. But try playing when you're nervous, and you can't make nice things come out. And it's very humbling. It's very humbling to fail a test. And do you know how humbling it is to get up, you know, from a time you spent alone with God, and you're just imagining that your face must glow like Moses' did when he came down from the mountain. You've had such a beautiful time with the Lord. And you walk out, and the first and slightest provocation that comes your way, and bam, your spirit is as bad as if you'd just been wrestling with the devil himself. That's humbling. Do you find yourself today in relative prosperity and comfort? Listen, don't think too highly of yourself. Just remember how you responded when someone accused you as you deemed falsely. Remember those feelings that came up in your heart. That's the kind of person you are. And you say, well, you know, why am I blessed? And he says there in verse 17, I didn't have this in my notes, but I saw it when we were reading. I think it's verse 17. Deuteronomy chapter 8. He said he did this so that you would not say in your heart, my power and the strength of my hand has given me this wealth. Well, why did it happen then? Well, this is beautiful. Go to chapter 10 and look at verse 14. Behold, to the Lord your God belong heaven and the highest heavens, and the earth and all that is in it. Okay, everything's God's. Verse 15. Why did it happen? Well, yet on your father did the Lord set his fathers did the Lord set his affection to love them, and he chose their descendants after them. Even you, and I imagine there's an exclamation point. I mean, even you, above all peoples. This is after he's told them they've been rebellious, as it is to this day. So why did he do it? Because he set his affection on you to love you. Because he chose you. Out of all the nations and peoples of the earth. Well, why did he love us? Is it because he has a soft heart for rebellious people? It's not at all that. It's because the God to whom belongs heaven and the highest heavens, the earth and all that is in it, chose you. That's right. That's the only explanation. He chose you and set his love and affection on you. And that is humbling. So what would God have us remember as we look back on past days of adversity? That God sovereignly ordained those days of adversity. That God designed those days to expose my heart. And that God exposed my heart to humble me. And there's one more point, but I just don't have time to develop it in this message. And it's really the climax of the passage. And you can read it for yourself there in verses, chapter 8, verse 3, especially and following. But we'll end on this note of humility. You know, what's the benefit of being humbled? Have you ever been really embarrassed? Oh man, I could tell you stories when I was a teen. It seemed like, you know, it seemed like torture all the times. And most of it was built up in my mind, I'm sure. But is there benefit in being humbled? Truly humbled? Well, Isaiah chapter 66 and verse 1 and 2 say this. Thus says the Lord, heaven is my throne and earth is my footstool. Remember, that's kind of what he said in Deuteronomy chapter 10. Where then is the house that you could build for me? And where is the place where I may rest? My hand made all things. Thus all things come into being, declares the Lord. And then he says this. But I own all things. I made all things. But this is the one on whom I will look. And boy, that should catch your attention. God saying he's going to look at somebody? To him who is humble and contrite of spirit and who trembles at my word. That's the person on whom God looks. So get this, people. If your failures, okay, I'm talking about failures, bad things. If your failures in times of affliction serve to humble you by exposing the wickedness in your heart, then those failures in those times of affliction will be to the saving of your soul. Because it's on the humble heart that God looks. And so we see, just as he gave the law and it was gracious, so he gives affliction and it's gracious in its intent because it serves to humble us when we see the way we naturally respond. The psalmist says in Psalm 119, he says, before I was afflicted, I what? Let me know. Yeah, I went astray. But now I keep thy word. Psalm 119:67. And in verse 71, he says, it is good for me that I was afflicted. That can be your testimony. That I may learn thy statutes. And then in verse 75, he says this, I know, O Lord, that in faithfulness thou hast afflicted me. It's his faithfulness. Even the affliction is his faithfulness. And that's why you have in one of the most weeping and saddest of the books of the Bible, the Lamentations of Jeremiah. You have him looking at it and saying, oh, great is your faithfulness. It's new every morning. Oh, the bitter pain and sorrow that a time could ever be when I proudly said to Jesus, all of self and none of thee. But he found me. I beheld him bleeding on the accursed tree, and my selfish heart said faintly, some of self and some of thee. Day by day, his tender mercies, healing, helping, full and free, brought me lower while I whispered, less of self and more of thee. Higher than the highest heavens, deeper than the deepest sea, Lord, thy love at last has conquered. None of self, and all of thee. And he uses affliction to do this. So what should our response be? It should be this. Have thine own way, Lord. Have thine own way. Thou art the potter. I am the clay. Mold me and make me after thy will while I am waiting, yielded and still.